The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Thank you very much, Shane.
The Criminal Courts of Justice, Dublin, Thursday, November 28th, 2019. After a 9-day trial, a case never before seen in Ireland comes to a conclusion.
A couple have been found guilty of female genital mutilation of their 1-year-old daughter 3 years ago in what is the first trial of its kind in this country.
6 weeks later, the married couple are back in court for sentencing.
Described the offence as the most egregious breach of trust by those presumed to be the protectors of their infant child.
Today, Judge Elma Sheehan sentenced the male accused to 5.5 years imprisonment and the female accused to 4 years and 9 months.
The couple are taken from the court and brought to prisons in different parts of the country to begin their sentences. They cannot believe what is happening.
The sentencing has been welcomed by advocacy groups and international aid organisations, highlighting the dangers of FGM.
Throughout the investigation, trial and sentencing, the couple maintained their innocence at all times.
A 37-year-old man and 27-year-old woman had pleaded not guilty to procuring an act of FGM.
The couple still say they never harmed their daughter. They say the Irish state put them in prison and removed their children from them, when none of that should have happened.
Now that was Ruth Negge introducing First Conviction, the latest podcast from the RT Documentary on One series, with RT Investigates as well, chronicling a case that very few of you may remember now, but it's hoped will reach its conclusion with a bid for a certificate of miscarriage of justice in January of next year. Pamela Frere, reporter with RT Investigates, and James McGuill, the solicitor for one of the couple at the centre of this case. And before we begin, just to warn that the conversation may not be suitable for little or vulnerable ears when we talk about the premise of this case. Good morning, Pamela. Good morning, James.
Morning. Good morning, Pat.
Pamela, I'll go to you first. I've been listening to the podcast. I've listened to the first five. The final episode is today to coincide with tonight's Primetime Investigates. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I was just horrified and shocked listening to, but fascinated at the same time with the unfolding events. Will you bring us back to how it all started?
Sure, Pat. So this story, it started nearly a decade ago and it's still ongoing. This started back in September 2016, back in a Southside Dublin home, family home. So you had a young couple with their 2 young children, a baby and a little toddler girl. They wake up as usual in the morning and the toddler girl has a dirty nappy. So the mum brings her into the bathroom to change her nappy. While she's cleaning up after that, the girl doesn't have a nappy on. She walks down the corridor to see her father, who's in the kitchen cooking the breakfast. He has this little light up ball. It makes sounds and it lights up and it frightened her. So she walks backwards into the hall. He continues what he's doing and he hears a scream. So he goes out, he picks her up, he's comforting her. The mum pops out to see what's happening here and she notices that there are drops of blood on his trousers. So they investigate there in the house. They can't find the source of the bleeding, but they're worried. They're really worried. So they bring her to Crumlin. They drive, everyone jumps into the car and they go to Crumlin. So when they arrive in Crumlin, you can see on CCTV that was shown in the trial that she's crawling on chairs and playing peekaboo with a woman.
In other words, she's not in any pain. She's behaving like a normal child.
She's in good form.
Yeah.
She's taken to theatre. Any bleeding that's there is stopped. The wounds are cauterised. And at that point, the hospital consultants are asking, how did this happen? The parents say that they don't know, but they believe that she fell on a toy. The mum brings the toy to the hospital. And it's at this point that the consultants are saying that they don't believe that this was the correct explanation for what happened. So they raise what's called an NAI red flag. That's a non-accidental injury red flag. And they have to instigate a protocol that goes with that. So TUSLA, the Gardaí, they're called.
Now, before you carry on, mm-hmm. let's just establish where the couple came from, because this is quite relevant in
sure.
terms of how everything was presented in court, I think.
They're from 2 countries in East Africa. We won't specifically be saying the country just sure. not to identify them, but that's where they're from. So you're correct. They are an African couple.
And in the area from which the woman came, there would have been female genital mutilation as part of this horrible culture that exists. And she actually was fleeing from that kind of culture.
She herself experienced FGM. She recounted to us the tale of when this was performed on her, and it was horrific. She finds it extremely upsetting to talk about, and she says that she would never want this for her own daughter. So this was something that she was trying to escape from, and now she's being accused of performing it. As a victim, she knew how horrible this procedure was.
Now, before any court case could advance, they had to get an expert in because there was no one in Crumlin with that kind of expertise.
Indeed.
Where did they find that expert?
The lead consultant for paediatric safety there, she contacted the UK-based expert in this area, Dr. Deborah Hodes. So she was given a copy of the materials available, colposcopes, and she made her determination from those images that this was FGM.
She never examined the child?
Never examined the child.
So this was just on visual imagery that was sent by Crumlin. And so it advanced then to a court case.
It did. In November 2019, the couple went on trial. It was a jury trial and they were found unanimously guilty.
Now, in the meantime, the children had been looked after by the couple, but under the supervision of Tusla. That
Indeed.
Was part of the whole scenario.
Tusla were very active in the family's life up until that point and continued on after. They found the supervision quite oppressive. Tusla were very involved in their lives at this time. Mm. And we have sight of case conference notes which indicate that Tusla had stated they believed the medical experts, they didn't believe the couple, and they wanted them to admit their guilt.
And that was part of the push all the time to get them to say that. And they, not having done it, how were they ever going to admit they harmed their own daughter?
Throughout everything in the last 10 years, they have maintained their innocence.
There's an interesting wrinkle in the whole account that the expert in the UK was aware of the case from tabloid headlines in Ireland.
I believe so.
And said, is that the case that I'm reading about?
Yes.
About a witch doctor being involved, all this sort of stuff, which was a complete tabloid fabrication.
At the time, there was a huge amount of sensationalised coverage about this case, as you say, mentions of a witch doctor. Because the couple were not necessarily on trial for having committed this themselves. They were on trial for having aided, abetted, procured this act. So this talk of a witch doctor who came over, did this and then fled. There was headlines about barbarism and barbaric acts and evil acts.
Now, you better explain to us about the languages that were the first languages of the couple, because this becomes very relevant in court.
Yes, so the husband gave testimony in his own defence and he speaks French. It's African French.
Yeah.
So in this instance, he's entitled under law and this is what we're supposed to provide for people who are accused, an interpreter. So the counsel were giving their questions to the interpreter. The interpreter was then translating that for the accused and his answers were then coming back through. And this is the way that trial one went.
And how did his wife then understand the proceedings?
He was in some instances then recounting the questions to her, the accused himself.
At times, the interpreter, which is against the rules, asked their own question.
And this is not the first time that I've heard of this happening. When the accused male was being questioned in the station, there was also times when the interpreter just started to ask their own questions.
Now, they were convicted.
They were.
And, they were then sent to separate prisons, leaving one child who was still breastfeeding at home. Mm.
Yes. So at this point, because there was such a duration between 2016 when the event happened and 2019 when they were on trial, the couple had actually had a third child, a little boy. And yes, he was only a few weeks old at the time that they were convicted. And yes, the mother was breastfeeding at this time. So there was no time for them once they were found guilty. That was it. She was sent to the Docus. He was sent to the Midlands prison and no chance to say goodbye to the children. And the children went into the care of relatives.
Like when they were convicted on that very day, they were taken away, separated and
gone.
Went to separate prisons.
Yes.
No chance to say goodbye. No chance to explain anything.
Or pack up your home or make arrangements. All gone.
How was life in prison for them?
Really tough. Extremely tough. As you can imagine, these people are black, African, Muslim in Irish prisons. And word has gotten out about the type of horrific crime that they've been accused of committing. And it is a horrific act. they really suffered in prison. She had a really tough time. But bear in mind, this is COVID. They're on lockdown 23 hours a day in their cells. So any time that they did get out of their cell, they were bullied.
Now, the extraordinary thing, being convicted of something you didn't do, something as horrific as female genital mutilation, is awful. But trying to, you know, in a foreign country, you know, a country that you've made your home, trying to find someone to help. But they did.
They did. They did find someone.
And that's where James McGill comes in. How did you get to hear about the case, James?
I got a letter from Saeed, the prisoner in the Midlands, and I was approached by some of members of his community, as they were very concerned about the safety of the conviction. They believed his protestations of innocence, and I was asked to meet with them and to see what we could do in terms of an appeal. So I did that.
And what was your reaction? I mean, I've listened to the podcast, so I'm reasonably informed of the story. But as it unfolded, I mean, did you find it instantly credible?
My first reaction was I need time to read it and to make an assessment. But one of the first things that leapt out at anyone reading the file was the poor quality of the interpretation, which really would have made this man look to the jury as though he was being evasive and dishonest, because the wrong questions were being translated to him and the answers that were translated back were wrong. So again, a simple example of it would be that if he was asked a question about his daughter and he was answering about a male, any juror would say that man is trying to avoid that question. So with the assistance of the then president of the Court of Appeal, who's himself a French speaker, we were able to get the recording of the evidence and get that to Dr. Mary Phelan in DCU. And she was some European...
An expert in translation.
Yeah. And she's active in a European body called ULITA. So with two European colleagues, they did a major study of this and prepared a report for the court. And it's worth saying in passing, in many countries, such as Germany, there would be no recording. I mean, it would be one person's word against the other. So, I mean, Saeed was lucky that we had the recording that could demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was substandard interpretation.
Now, people might say, well, if there was a translation difficulty, these people, you know, they're looking to get off on a technicality. But there was much more than that, because the whole question of the expertise that was brought to bear on the child was questioned and was found to be deficient.
And Pat, so as part of James, the team there, what they did was that they went about sourcing a new medical expert who actually had expertise in this area. The original expert for the couple, he didn't have any expertise in this area. So James managed to source a lady called Professor Birgitta Essen from Sweden, and she's seen thousands of cases of FGM. She spent decades looking at this, and she is actually the only person to physically examine this child.
And her conclusion was that there had been no genital mutilation. There was no interference with the genital area at all.
At all. And she made that conclusion, Pat, by looking at the injury at the time and then years later. Her opinion did not change. It was the same. And as we now know, the state's own new medical expert, Dr. Berger, she also says it didn't happen.
So what was the next legal process that you had to go through?
Well, we had to apply to the court for permission to adduce new evidence, because this wasn't raised at the trial.
Yeah.
And there was no scientist called for the couple at the trial. And permission of that kind is not easily got from the Court of Appeal. So we ran the 2 points. We had exceptionally oral evidence heard from the medical witnesses. And the court insisted that the prosecution were entitled to recall the witnesses who had given evidence for the prosecution on the basis of fairness.
Yeah.
And we now make the criticism that that same fairness is not being displayed, in that the prosecution has not provided Dr. Berger, the prosecution witness, the prosecution expert's report to the other medical witnesses, to give them an opportunity of saying, actually, we were wrong. Looking back on it now, this is not. And we have, you know, there was the 2016 colposcopy is what Professor Essen had to work with. But there was a 2019 one that wasn't provided prior to the trial, which was clearer and of better quality and of a more mature child. And then we were able to do so, the professor arranged a physical examination in the Mater Hospital. video recorded by an expert forensic medical photographer, videographer. The prosecution were invited to attend that, wouldn't do it. But when we were able to send the up-to-date photographs and reports of Professor Essen, and they were provided to another specialist, also by chance in Sweden, there was no doubt. And if anything, Dr. Berger's report when it came back was even more strident, concluding with the conclusion that not alone was there no FGM, but there was no attempt at FGM.
Okay, so what then happens to the couple? They are both behind bars.
No, we got them out on bail after the conviction was quashed the first time.
Yeah, but we haven't really got to that part of the narrative yet. Yeah, when did you get the conviction quashed?
In November 2021. So that was 2 years after they went into custody. And then they were admitted to bail pending an application for a retrial, and a retrial was directed. The bail conditions were strict. They were under supervision. They were on signing on obligations. And then we move on to the retrial. Now, by this stage, we had asked the Court of Appeal for permission to have a physical examination conducted by Professor Essen. And that was declined, but there were complications. It was in the middle of COVID, and someone was going to have to travel to somebody. And there was a two-week period and all the rest of it. So there was no physical exam available to Professor Essen before giving evidence in the retrial, where the jury disagreed. They couldn't come to a conclusion, which is understandable enough. And then the prosecution indicated they want to go for a further trial, and a date for January of 2024 was fixed for that. And at that stage, we were able to arrange for Professor Essen to do a physical examination. And as I say, the prosecution were invited to participate. They declined to do so, but we made all the materials available to them. And by this stage, Dr. Hodes had declared herself either unwilling or unable.
This is the original expert
who
yeah.
just basically went missing.
Okay.
And hasn't, we believe, been shown Dr. Berger's findings or Professor Essen's videography, which you know demonstrates that just and expert witnesses should be prepared to concede when they're wrong.
What was the outcome of that retrial?
The retrial was a hung jury. Then we went to go for the next trial. But by then, the prosecution had an expert report indicating there was no crime committed at all, and therefore they didn't proceed with it.
So they enter what they call a nolle prosequi.
Yeah.
Now, that does not mean an acquittal.
No.
So as far as the couple are concerned, there is still a stain over their character. And, I mean, they suffered being pilloried in their own community because their own community are not gung-ho for FGM, quite the opposite.
Yeah.
They would be horrified by the idea that someone would perpetrate FGM within their own community. So they were ostracized. Mm-hmm. So they need desperately to clear their names entirely that for the Irish state to say, we got it badly wrong.
That's all that's required, is for the state to turn around and accept the logic of the science. And the science has been conclusively in favour of the couple and conclusively against the evidence originally given by the English expert.
What are the implications, Pamela, for the state if they actually put their hands up and say, at every level along the way, we made mistakes?
Well, it's huge. Even in cost terms, it's going to be huge. I mean, if the couple are successful in their certificate of miscarriage of justice, cost compensation could follow that. But also, look over the last 10 years. I mean, putting them in jail for 721 days, that cost the state €320,000. Look at the 54 months that a team of Tusla care workers had to supervise the family. Look at how much money has been paid for the interpreters. Look how much has been paid on legal fees throughout. But in terms of this as a legal first, the prosecution being a legal first, the landmark appeal on the basis of translation being a legal first, I think there will be lessons to be learned here.
Now, the question of translation and the quality of translation, you have, if you like, some breaking news on that, don't you?
Indeed, Pat. So we can reveal that the Court Service of Ireland has confirmed to Orty Investigates that the interpreter who was involved in this trial was involved in 246 other cases. And 40 of those cases were held after the successful appeal when the appeal court judges had referred to the conviction as being unsafe and unsatisfactory. And those cases were all over the country. They include 26 for the High Court, predominantly in the Central Criminal Court.
So how is a translator selected? I mean, what kind of qualifications do they have to have? How are they vetted? Because clearly in this one case that we know definitively, the translation was utterly inadequate.
Well, Pat, we don't have the same safeguards as other European countries, despite the fact that we should do. There are as I said, no safeguards. We don't have a centralised register. We don't have state testing. We don't have certification. You can have a higher, you can have a degree in a higher subject, but it doesn't have to be a language. You just have to speak another language. And as much as the companies, the private companies who provide these interpreters might say that they offer their own training, there's not a state supervised exam for those people who come into the court. And as I was just saying to James, that you can have some of the most highly educated people in the court, being the lawyers, the medical experts, the consultants, the forensic people, the judge, but the person who's communicating to the accused and then have his evidence back to the jury is the interpreter.
But even the notion that the husband in this case had to translate for his wife, you know, so much can be lost in all of those translations.
There were so many opportunities for the accused husband to make his testimony clear to the jury, and he didn't get that chance.
Now, James, what needs to happen next? January 2026 is the next opportunity for the right thing to be done.
Yes, and you're going to have to be decided by the Court of Appeal. It's a two-day hearing. Obviously, I can't say much about it because it's before the court. But just to continue on the interpretation point, because it's a really important point, I mean, what the state have chosen to do here is to give a national contract to one company and then to walk away from taking any quality control. So that therefore, as I was watching it before, you asked me the question, you were taking notes of what Pam was saying. Like, we see this all the time. We see interpreters who don't take a note of what is being said, even though a question might be lengthy and convoluted. And if you don't take a note, you have no chance of properly translating it.
So they're doing it as if they were in the United Nations translating a speech. They're doing it as they go, kind of thing.
Well, except in the United Nations, you hope that they have proper training, which, you know, think of all the Irish people that are now working in Brussels translating documents into the Irish language. They all have training to do that. I mean, courtroom interpretation, a police station interpretation, that's a very specific thing. You need to have training for it. And it's not good enough for the state to say, oh, we have someone who speaks French and someone who speaks, or someone who has a third level degree. What is needed is a person who has the training in translation and interpretation with a third level degree in language.
Well, we hope that justice will be done this coming January. First Conviction podcast series is available wherever you get your podcast. The last edition of that is coming out today. And Primetime Investigates coverage of the case is at 9:35 tonight, Pamela.
It is.
And Pamela, the reporter on that programme for RT Investigates, Pamela Frere, thank you very much. And James McGill, solicitor, thank you very much.
Thanks, Pat.
We'll take a break.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.